Radio.
Guinness and God presents Archbishop Mark Coleridge speaking on the topic, The Church, the Greatest Show on Earth? Guinness and God is brought to you by the Catholic Life Archdiocesan Team of the Archdiocese of Canberra and Goulburn.
Have you ever heard of Anne Rice? You have. No one's heard of Anne Rice. Well, I hadn't until recently either, but apparently she's written a string of highly successful Gothic novels. I've never read one of them, and I doubt that I ever will. But apparently she was born Catholic, but gave it away very early in life. She was sick of the whole damn thing. But then in... not that many years ago, she made a big comeback, as it were. It really wasn't a comeback. She found her way to Jesus and into the church. And so she became a bit of a celebrity in certain church circles because she was someone who had said no and then said yes. Well, just recently, she's decided to say no again. And that's where I read about her today. She's sick of the whole thing. She's sick of the church. And she said she still loves Jesus, but she is sick of Christianity. So she's all for Christ and sick to death of Christianity. And I would say that a lot of people are in that boat. If you go to a New Age bookshop, I won't ask you to put up your hand if you have, but you'll find lots of books about Jesus. Have you noticed? Come in. Well, take it from me, they're there. All right, so lots of books about Jesus, but you won't find a single book about the church. So there again is the problem. A lot of people like Jesus, or they like the Jesus they think is Jesus. Whether it's the real Jesus is another question, but they don't like the church. Now, I wouldn't mind betting that in some corner of your heart, there's a little bit of that too. And I have to say, in some corner of my heart, there's probably a little bit of that too. I mean, I see far more of the dark side of the church than any of you ever will, unless you become bishops. Anyone here putting up their hand? Yeah. Oh, hang on. Oh, I shouldn't have said it. No, I mean, I see the underbelly of the church. But you see, there are some people who think that once upon a time the church was perfect. You know, that Jesus founded the church, which is kind of true. I'll come back to that in a minute. And the church in those early days was just beautiful. In fact, it was so beautiful, it was perfect. But then something went wrong. It's hard to say exactly when, and it's hard to say exactly what, but we began to go downhill fairly early on. And we've been going down, down, down at breakneck speed ever since. So we've reached a point now where we've got a world, as it were, full of Anne Rices, saying, I love Jesus, but I hate the church. Now, I've got news for all of you, and I'm going to impart a few facts here tonight. Cheers. The church, you ready for this? This is news. The church was always a mess. Sorry. I'll say it again, it's so shocking. The church was always a mess. And to see what I mean, you've only got to read the New Testament. When did you last do that? Hands up. No, don't. You've only got to... And I read the New Testament. I studied it professionally. I've taught it. So I know a little bit about it. You've only got to read the New Testament to see that, first of all, the band of disciples that Jesus gathered around him initially were a mess. They were as thick as a brick. And Jesus rubs their nose in their dumbness. They betray Jesus at the end. One of them turns him in for 30 pieces of silver. Do you see what I mean? They were a mess. And then, if you read the letters of St. Paul, letters that were written in that supposedly golden age, you see that if you think we've got problems these days in the church, just try the church at Corinth sometime. The church at Corinth, one of the great Pauline churches, was a real mess. Okay, so I'm going to start with that claim. I mean, the church, irrelevant, institutionalized, intellectualized. I'll come back to that later, but I'm starting with the claim the church was always a mess. There was no golden age. And if you're looking for a golden age or a perfect church, then go somewhere else. It's not the way it ever was, and it's not the way it ever will be. The church that was a mess from day one will be a mess at doomsday. Now, the only question, therefore, is do you have the eye that sees the magnificence at the heart of the mess? Because it's there if you've got eyes to see it. And if I didn't think I had an eye to see the magnificence at the heart of the mess, I wouldn't be standing here now. I certainly wouldn't be a bishop. I certainly wouldn't be a priest. I mean, when I left school, I didn't have the slightest inkling of the priesthood. I was going to be a diplomat. Can you believe it? That's true. The Australian ambassador in Baghdad or somewhere. Can you imagine it? Okay. But the reason, I was a university student, like many of you, but the reason why I even gave the priesthood the slightest thought, or one, I ran out of steam with diplomacy. I thought to myself, I don't want to be a diplomat. And then I thought to myself, well, what do I want to be? And it was at that time that I met three priests at the university. They were then young priests. They're now old. In fact, one of them rang me today. He's just celebrated his 50 years of ordination. And the thing about that encounter with those three priests at the university was I saw for the first time what the church could be. A whole new vista of possibility opened up, because I'd grown up in a parish in Melbourne that had had a great old Irishman as parish priest for 40 years. Now, you know, it wasn't exactly the liveliest place in town, and nor was he the liveliest priest in town. And seeing that, I mean, I respected him, but I saw that and I thought, no, that's certainly not a path into the future for me. But when I met these younger guys, it was as if my eyes were opened and I began to see the magnificence at the heart of the mess. And it's that vision that's kept me going for more than 40 years since those days at university. I mean, I'm now 36 years ordained. Can you believe it? 8 years a bishop. Feels like 80. But it's that same vision that sustains me from day to day. As I deal with the problems, the hassles, the dark underbelly of the church, if I didn't have that sense of the magnificence at the heart of the mess, I couldn't do it even. Not only would I not be, I just couldn't do what I'm asked to do. Now, the question therefore is, what is the magnificence at the heart of the mess? Well, I can tell you now, as one who worked, say, in the Vatican, it's not the glories of the church's art and architecture. I mean, that's a fantastic thing. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about our triumphs of the past. What I am talking about is the presence of Jesus Christ risen from the dead. Can I just focus on this? And this is where Anne Rice, in one sense, is right. Can I just focus on this? That the whole thing of the church stands or falls on a single fact. And the fact is that Jesus Christ, all right, so you've got to focus on Jesus. Without him, the church is completely irrelevant, institutionalized, and clapped out, a waste of time and worse. All right, so Jesus Christ was crucified, all right, executed as a criminal. That was a fact. And then he was raised from the dead. Now, it's amazing how we forget that that's what the whole thing stands or falls on. In other words, a Jesus who isn't once upon a time, but who is always and everywhere if you've got an eye to see him and an ear to hear him. And once you see him and hear him, he, as it were, consumes your whole life. The real Jesus doesn't come at you as good old plastic Jesus you can pick up in a New Age shop. The real Jesus comes at you like a tsunami, comes out of nowhere. You're sitting on a balcony and you say, oh, that's a big wave, isn't it? And then the next thing, you're swept away into another life. All right, so it's that encounter which kind of claims your whole being. In my case, that meant becoming a priest and eventually, though I didn't know it, a bishop. All right, so we want to give Jesus a bit, pay him off, as it were, and he claims everything. I don't know what it means for you in your life, but you've got to work that out, I think, if you're serious about Christian discipleship. Now, what was true of me and what is true of me, that it's that encounter with Jesus that is the magnificence at the heart of the mess. If the church doesn't lead you to that, and if the church doesn't lead you more and more deeply into that experience of encounter, then forget it. The church is shocking and even diabolical if it doesn't lead you to that encounter with the Jesus who isn't once upon a time, and if it doesn't lead you more and more deeply into that experience of the encounter. Forget the church. Now, at this point, I just want to go back in time. So come with me in a kind of a time machine. What did Jesus do when he trod the earth? I mean, question, did he found the church? Am I still on camera? Yes, Fernando. I was going to wander over there. Jesus did found the church, but you've got to understand what that means. Okay? He didn't establish local communities. He did something different. He called into being a kind of a movement. Sometimes it is called by the scholars the Jesus movement. Okay? In other words, a group that gathered around Jesus who traveled the country roads of first century Palestine, preaching what they called the kingdom of God. All right, so a group of itinerant preachers wandering around rural Palestine in the first century, preaching the reign of God. In other words, that God is about to intervene in a way that is once and for all. That is final, okay? That this intervention was about to happen. Now, Jesus depended upon local support, but he didn't set up local communities, and yet we think that you can't have the church without local community. Jesus stayed with people like Martha, Mary, and Lazarus whenever he went to Jerusalem. Okay, so he doesn't found local communities. He calls into being a movement of itinerant preachers. He himself then is executed. They scatter. And then they meet him in that moment of encounter that changes everything. What happens eventually is that the Christian movement, the Jesus movement, moves out of Palestine. And once it does, it moves out into what's called the Mediterranean basin, the world of the Mediterranean. And as soon as it does that, it becomes, first of all, urban. It's in the cities. Christianity becomes an urban phenomenon. It leaves the countryside in Palestine and enters the cities of the Mediterranean world. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is Christianity becomes essentially geared to the experience of community. And that's really when the church, as we know it, begins to take off. So Jesus sets something in motion that becomes the local communities that we think of when we think of the church. Now those communities were communities under pressure. And a crucial experience in the life of the church in those early phases was the experience of suffering and persecution. That posed a key question. And the question was this: is this death or is this birth? You see, you had become a Christian, let's imagine. Why? Because you'd heard a great promise of new life. Joy, peace, the fullness of life, all those good things. And then it emerges that you're going to be thrown to the lions for lunch. What might you be tempted to do? You might be tempted to do just what many did and say, I'm out of here. This wasn't the deal. I didn't become Christian to be thrown to the lions for lunch. Is this experience of suffering and persecution death or is it birth? Because what the New Testament says, and this is crucial for understanding where we are on our journey through time at this point of history. The New Testament says you better know the difference between the pangs of birth and the pangs of death, because they both have pangs, they both hurt. But if you confuse the pangs of death with the pangs of birth, you're caught up in the most fundamental confusion of all, and you're in deep trouble. And what eventually they came to understand in a place like Rome, and with the help of a text like Mark's Gospel, is that in fact this experience of suffering and persecution, far from it looked like death, but in fact it was life, it was birth. Why? Because they could interpret their experience in the light of Jesus' experience of the cross and the resurrection. The death of Jesus, what did it look like? It looked like death. What was it? In fact, it was birth. All right, so they looked at the cross and understood the truth of their own experience. Now, in many ways, the church in our own time, here and now, is going through a dark time, an experience of the cross. But is it birth or is it death? Now, if you say it's death, then of course the church is institutionalized, irrelevant, intellectualized, and worse. But if you can understand, if you have the eye that sees that this dark time, in fact, is a time of life, a time of birth, then things look different. Now, beyond what they call sometimes the tide of blood, the time of suffering and persecution, there came a crucial moment in history when the Emperor Constantine, you've heard of him? The Emperor Constantine decided that Christianity was a good thing for his empire. And it was eventually a good thing for him because Constantine was only baptized on his deathbed. Now, what happened then was that the church became part of the establishment. And you had a new kind of intermingling between church and state. And we've been living with that up until very recent times. The church became respectable. The church became much more heavily institutionalized. For instance, the emperor gave the Bishop of Rome land on which to build his cathedral. All right, so in all kinds of ways, the church settled down. The church did become institutionalized, but the church did not become politically irrelevant. In fact, the church became increasingly powerful politically, and that was a very mixed blessing. This was the time that gave birth to one of the great figures of Christian history who always fascinates me, the man we know as St. Anthony of Egypt. Have you ever heard of him? He's the first of the desert fathers. He goes off into the desert when he hears the gospel of today's Mass, in fact. Today's gospel at Mass was the rich young man, where Jesus says, go and sell everything, give it to the poor, and then come follow me. Anthony of Egypt heard those words, and he gave away everything, and he went off into the desert to lead a life that many thought was mad, but which became the seed of a Christianity into the future. And these great figures like Anthony of Egypt are crucial. And I'll say it now, we need one or some of them now. And why shouldn't there be one or some of them sitting here now? Do you think Anthony of Egypt was any different from you, Patrick Ourigan? Well, you just happen to be in my line of vision. But why did he go off into the desert because we needed a new kind of martyrdom. What does the word martyr mean? The Greek word for martyr means witness. In other words, they were no longer being fed to the lions for lunch. The great epic of blood was over. So Christianity, in its extreme form, had to find a new kind of martyrdom. So Anthony's life in the desert was a kind of living martyrdom. The great struggle, the agonia, to use the word in Greek, that they use for the martyrs, the agony. So he goes off into the desert and lives a new kind of martyrdom. And therefore, the question today, I think, is, what are our new kinds of martyrdoms? Do we have to go? It's unlikely, I think, that you're going to be fed to the lions for lunch or stood up against a wall and shot, but it can happen. I sometimes think we might need, in this part of the world, some martyr bishops, as long as it's not me. Yet what are our forms of martyrdom? You know, in other words, we need... So the problem with Christianity at times, I think, is not that it's institutionalized and intellect. It can be just so one-dimensional and boring. I think what you're looking for, and what I'm looking for in another way as bishop, is more of the poetry of the risen Lord, more of the poetry of Christianity, and kind of a quality of extreme life that can look mad, but which in fact is the ultimate sanity. So what can we do to discover more and to live more of the poetry of Christianity and to move beyond that sort of insipid, boring, one-dimensional, half-hearted living of the Christian life that will always deaden the soul and drive you and everyone else mad? See, we're so intent on being sensible, and yet where in the New Testament does Jesus say anywhere, come on, boys and girls, let's be sensible? He doesn't say that kind of thing. And in this country, at times we can be so determined to be respectable as the church and so determined to win acceptance. Now, you're younger than I am, almost. In fact, everyone in this room, I think I am the oldest. But Louis, are you older than me? Not by much. And a lot fitter. But what was I going to say then? I was distracted by the thought of my own age. What was I talking about? Kevin, help me. Jiffy, what was I saying? Can anyone help me? We are. Thank you, Michael. What I was saying is, you who are younger than I am, forget the experience of being Catholic in this country, the experience of discrimination and prejudice. You know, advertisements for jobs with Catholics need not apply. All right, so it was hard, hard going for Catholic people in this country, and we can't forget it. I'll just remind you of that. But as a result, one of the things that we can be is kind of craving an acceptability. You know, the bishops years ago, they took a decision to set up Catholic schools. Now, most of you, or not many of you at least, went to excellent Catholic schools, and it's one of the great achievements of the church in this country. But the whole point of our schools, in one sense, was to get us out of the ghetto of prejudice and discrimination. And it was a triumphant success. But the question is now, in some sense, where do we go from up? You know, we've gone up the ladder, but where do we go from up? Now, what I'm saying is that we can be so intent upon making ourselves acceptable that we're afraid of being countercultural. We want to be loved. We want to be respected. And that there's something profoundly human in all of that, a deep pathos. But in the end, if you're following the crucified and risen Christ, which is the magnificence of the church, you can't be so caught up in the craving for respectability and acceptance that you say no to his call into something which may not be respectable and may not win you the plaudits of the crowd or even the votes of the electorate. Okay. Constantine, and the centuries beyond reaching up to our own time, a church much more enmeshed in culture, less countercultural, more caught up in the structures of power, and I have to say, I suppose, privilege, where the bishop was often the prince as well. There were, up until very recent times, there were prince bishops who were not only the church leaders, but who were the leaders of government in places like Salzburg and many other places around Europe. In a sense, that was a very Catholic thing. Because one thing about the Catholic Church is we're not like the Amish people. You know, the Amish people who reject all modern culture and modern progress and all, that's not the Catholic style. The Catholic style has always been, certainly at its best, to engage culture. All right, so not to stand apart from the world or back from the world, but to engage the culture genuinely, albeit critically. So there's something deeply Catholic in all of this that takes its cue from the Incarnation. Do you know what I mean by the Incarnation? The Word was made flesh. That's the fundamental impulse, that sense of God in flesh, fundamental impulse at the heart of the Catholic experience, the Catholic Church. All right, so we are a church who accept flesh and who look for the Word at the heart of flesh, and that's the magnificence at the heart of the mess, because the flesh is always messy. The world is a messy place. Human institutions are messy. I mean, everyone complains about, you know, the current election campaign and, oh, the system's no good, but they forget that that's the way of a fallen world. All right, and if you're looking for the perfect society, go to another planet. Don't stay here. All right, so flesh is a mess. But if you take your leave of the flesh, you take your leave of Jesus, and in the end you take your leave of the real God. I tell you now, every heresy that Christianity has ever known, in a sense they all resolve to the same heresy. And the heresy is this, that the flesh is bad. I don't like the mess. I want to escape this world. I have to escape my humanity in order to discover the divinity. Do you see what I mean? In other words, at the heart of every heresy that's ever been and will ever be, there is the denial of the incarnation. So as the church gets swept up more and more into the flesh of things, there is something deeply Catholic about it, but there were also shadows. Some would say that when Constantine, the emperor, embraced the church or Christianity, he just about choked the life out of it. Now, in the 20th century, and here again I can't go into the complexities of history in a short span like this, but in the 20th century, what we have seen and are seeing in our own time is the end of what is sometimes called the Constantinian era. And a lot of people lament the fact that the church is more and more pushed to the margin of public life. And I'm one of those at times who complain most about that very thing. Because I think the drive to... We all know that there's a kind of secularist ideology as distinct from secularization, which can be a good thing, but I think you know what I mean when I talk about a secularist ideology. It's all around us like acid rain. And what it would do, it would drive not only Christianity and certainly the Catholic Church, its most repulsive form in the view of some, but would drive religion generally out of the public square. Now, it's that in itself is a deeply ambivalent phenomenon, but we are living with it now, and it's not going to stop. So what we need to do, I think, is to be discerning. In other words, to step back from a kind of engagement with the political world and the structures of power that was never appropriate to the disciples of Jesus Christ or to the community of the church. But at the same time, to maintain a genuine and powerful engagement with the gospel, with the culture in which we find ourselves. In other words, it's the incarnation. Again, we have to be in the world but not of it. That's so easy to say, and I say it often. It's not easy to get right in particular circumstances. But we, and I do mean we, not just the bishops, but you. I mean, some of you are politicians, Ed and Michael, you're involved in politics as well, and so on. But it doesn't matter whether you're a politician or a bishop or whatever you are, you're students, a lot of you. We all have to engage the culture, the flesh of things, with the unique and infinite creative power of what we call the gospel. Just by the way, what is the gospel? This is a big footnote. I'm often amazed at the things we take for granted. You know, I throw the word gospel around. Yeah, we all know what the gospel is. Do you know what the gospel is? Well, I mean, you know, we can talk about it later, but Jesus is the gospel. The gospel's not a message I can write down on a bit of paper and say, there's the gospel, Andrew. What you find in the New Testament is a kind of an echo of the gospel, the voice of Christ himself. But in the end, it is Jesus Christ, crucified and risen, who is the good news. What do I mean by that? When he rises from the dead, he's still got his scars. All right? The only difference is that the scars shine like the sun. So what's it all say? The good news is this, that there is no wound, either personal or communal, nor even the cosmic wound of death, that cannot become a fountain of life. There is no death of any kind that cannot become life. There is no weakness of any kind that cannot become strength. Now, if you think about that, it is fantastically good news, because at times you and I, either individually or communally or cosmically, we drown in a tsunami of weakness or death that seems to have the last word. Not true. Not true. That's the mess, and only the mess. But if you see the magnificence at the heart of the mess, you've heard the gospel. In other words, you've met Jesus and heard his voice and seen his face. That's the good news. It's not a message that's disembodied. The good news is him. Again, I'm just at times amazed at how often we can forget that. Now, what I am saying, again in this thumbnail sketch of our journey through time, is that the church is passing through a moment of crisis. Now, don't think that it's the first time in our history, but this is a moment of crisis. And the word crisis in English comes from the Greek, krisis, which means judgment. So we're under judgment in a time like this, and in the end, it's not human judgment, but God's judgment. Okay, now, what do I mean by crisis? I mean that we're at a point of passing through deep, often unexpected, and certainly permanent change that often looks and feels like death. Our institutions are not what they once were. I've been fighting a war, was what I had in mind, about Calvary Hospital in recent times. And in some ways it is a defence of Catholic institutions, but that's not at the heart of it. What it is a defence of the power of the gospel at the heart of healthcare. In other words, do you want Jesus in the hospital or not? That sounds almost absurd, but that's what it gets down to. All right, but we know our schools are still extraordinary institutions, but they are not what they were for all kinds of reasons. We don't have the great houses of formation, you know, filled with nuns and brothers and priests and all that. And so in many ways, it's a time of institutional diminishment, when our institutional clout is not what it used to be. I mean, I don't have politicians banging on my door or lining up to speak to the Archbishop. Some do, some don't. I read today that President Sarkozy of France is probably the first president of the French Republic who doesn't regard the Archbishop of Paris as a prime interlocutor in his political conversation. That's what I'm talking about. This phenomenon is more dramatic in many ways in Europe than it is in Australia, but it's dramatic enough here. I mean, Cardinal Pell, you know the name, and he has clout, there's no question about that. But it's not the kind of clout that Archbishop Mannix of Melbourne had 50, 60, 70 years ago or more. It's more personal than institutional. As Archbishop of Canberra, I can tell you now that my position guarantees almost no automatic access. Doors do not open to me automatically as they would have opened to my predecessors. You know, for instance, Archbishop O'Brien, we've got Eris O'Brien. Where are you, Eris? Oh, there you are. You were over here before. We had a same name, Eris O'Brien, would you believe it? The then Prime Minister, Mr. Menzies, used to come up regularly to Archbishop's house there on the hill to have a meal with Archbishop O'Brien. Why? Mainly because you couldn't get a decent meal in Canberra, not like now. And O'Brien had an Italian chef who could cook. So Menzies would come up and have a decent Italian meal with the Archbishop, a glass of wine, which was also hard to get in Canberra in those days, can you imagine? And but those were the days when being the Archbishop just opened doors automatically. It's not like that now for me or for any of us, I have to say. All right, so a time of radical transition that is very hard to read in many ways and can be both painful and perplexing. But I come back to my fundamental question. Is it birth or is it death? If I didn't think it was birth, again, I'd walk out the door now. I've got not the slightest interest in presiding over a funeral, and I don't think I'm doing it. I see myself more as a rather ungainly and perhaps poorly trained midwife. Briggings? Yeah, I do. The bishop as midwife in the sense of bringing something to birth. But I tell you what, it's not easy. In fact, I'd have to say after 8 years as a bishop, it's harder than I ever thought it would be, even in this diocese. It's not easy. And it does consume my whole being. There's not a day go by that I don't think, how is the midwife to work? And we're at a point now where I often think this, we're like Abraham. We can't see where we're going. And that's disconcerting. A lot of people talk to me about the need for planning. You know, we've got to have a pastoral plan. And if we don't have a pastoral plan, then where the hell, what are we going to do? But I think sometimes, I mean, we do need to plan for the future. It's not going to just happen. Believe me, it's not going to just happen. Fall into our lap. But sometimes the talk about, even obsessive talk about the need to plan for the future or plan the future really conceals an anxiety about an Abrahamic moment. You know the story of Abraham? God called him to leave everything and just follow, but he didn't give Abraham a roadmap, even though Abraham wanted a roadmap. And I'd love a roadmap too. I wish God would give me a beautiful big roadmap that I could stand up here and read to you. And then we'd all live happily ever after because we'd know exactly where we're going. That's not the way it is, folks. Sorry. So go back to Abraham. We say we're sons and daughters of Abraham. We'll start living it. I have to live with it every day, and so do you, I guess, in all. But as a community, again, if all we're going to do is plan our way beyond anxiety, only to take ourselves more deeply into anxiety, the church is, of course, going to be hopelessly institutionalised, irrelevant, clapped out, death-dealing. In the Abraham stories in the book of Genesis, which are the story of us, it's not just once upon a time, those stories are us. This is your life. All right, now, things only go really wrong when Abraham takes over and plans his own future. He thinks he's being so smart. But in fact, that's when things go wrong. Because God continually leads him into a strange place. And Abraham says, this is not the deal at all. Remember, he was a successful businessman. He says, this wasn't the deal at all. Okay? I'm going to take control and I'll plan the future. Thank you. Now, that we could be in the same situation. All right, I think this is an Abrahamic moment where we've just got... The only hope Abraham had was if he kept his eye and ear on the only one who did know where it was all going, and that was God. So I think this is a moment where we as a church, if we want to avoid all the horrors and in fact become the greatest show on earth, we have to keep our eye and ear on the only one who does know where the hell we're going and to whom the future belongs, and I mean Jesus Christ, risen from the dead. That's why I say that this is a moment, I think, where the church is being called into a new experience and depth of prayer that I would call contemplative. We need a new contemplation, all of us. Sometimes we used to think, or perhaps we still do, that contemplatives live in monasteries, you know, Carmelites and Cistercians and Benedictines, and but the rest of us just bumble along, you know, with a Hail Mary here and there. No, no. Karl Rahner, a great German theologian, said not that many years ago, the Christian of the future, like us, is either going to be a mystic or nothing. Take your pick. All right, now the word mystic is slippery, but you've got to go... So what's it mean for you to go to a new depth of prayer? What's it mean for you to live a contemplative life? I don't care who you are or what you're doing. Because unless... By that I mean keeping your eye on Jesus. Don't get distracted, because God knows it's easy to get distracted. Keep your ear on Jesus. Listen to him. Learn to listen to him more and more deeply. The word, his word in Scripture, but all in all kinds of places. All right, so that's fundamental. The other thing that flows from that, I think, is that in a moment like this, we need to go more deeply into the experience of communion that comes from meeting Jesus and that is the heart of the church. We are not a glee club. The New Testament uses that word communion, or in Greek, if you like, koinonia, to describe the incredible experience of human community, human togetherness, brothers and sisters, flesh and blood to each other. Now, you know, at times we fight like hell, we have pot shots at one another, and we're no different. So we have to learn new ways of being the church in the way we relate to each other. This might be one of the ways in which we do it, and a lot of people find this experience in smaller communities rather than in big parish communities or in dioceses. I don't know. I don't really care, in one sense, where and how you find it. But you will find it, and you've got to find it, if in fact it's the real Jesus that you've met. Because I tell you now, if you think you can have Jesus without the community we call the church, with all its mess, then I'd say almost certainly you'll end up with a Jesus who looks and sounds just like you. You'll end up worshipping yourself. And the Jesus who fills these New Age bookshops is really a mirror. He looks and sounds just like you and me. And that's not what we need. There's no salvation there, no life, but death. All right, so I would say from my own experience, the only guarantee that I'm in touch with the real Jesus, seeing him and hearing him, is that I'm doing it at the heart of the church for all the mess of the institution. Just by the way, there are people who talk about the institutional church as if that was somehow spawned by from Satan, and that there's some other kind of church, a spiritual church. Perhaps, I'm not sure what the opposite is. The only church that I know is institution. I mean, that word is not a dirty word. What I mean is it's flesh, it's a real community. That's what I'm talking about, human beings. And wherever you get human beings in community, there are structures of one kind or another. But we are at a time when we need to be very sure that all our structures are a response to grace and not a substitute for grace. You know what I mean by grace? The free gift of a perfect love costs you nothing, and it's total. But when structures substitute for that, that's when you've got a church that is deadening institution. Because it's only the mess and the magnificence is gone. The glory has left the temple. Okay? So flowing from that experience of contemplation, meeting Jesus, seeing him, hearing, learning what it means to be the church more and more deeply, that experience of the communion that is in Christ, and then out of that womb, as it were, to become a church in a moment like this that is more missionary. I get sick of the sound of my own voice saying this, that we are at a time where because it looks like, you know, we're going out of business and it's all institutional diminishment, doom and gloom, and oh, I can't see the future. We can be very tempted to circle the wagons and lick our wounds, cry in our beer, how the glasses, all right? But that, I think that's the exact opposite of what the Spirit is saying to the churches now. I think perhaps the most important question for me as a bishop, if I could share it with you here, is what do we have to do as a church to become more missionary? And I sometimes wonder, look, does it mean, you know, in the parishes, we just train people to go out two by two and knock on doors and get doors slammed in their face or God knows what? But that might sound ridiculous, but do you see what I mean? The church isn't just like a supermarket where you come and you take the spiritual goodies and go home and consume them furiously and end up spiritually obese. The church is not like that. Why did Jesus call the church into being? Because he wanted the church to go out and share the good news with the whole of the creation, as he says himself, the end of Matthew's gospel. So I don't know how else to say it. And I sometimes wonder myself, in all the things I do as a bishop, would I be better off just going down into Civic or somewhere, or Woden, the shopping mall, and talking to people about Jesus? I don't know. Again, it's not what bishops are supposed to do, and I've got to sign letters and write the ones I sign, I guess, and all that sort of... No, in fact, in the Vatican, they say in the Vatican, if you work there for 30 years... For 15 years, you write letters that you never sign, and for the next 15 years, you sign letters that you never write. And it's true. But look, that's where we are as the church. Now, talking of the Vatican, when I went there to work, it came as a bolt out of the blue. People said to me, oh, why'd you apply for the job? Apply? It was tough settling in, because it's another culture. It was like going to another planet. But I'd say, looking back, those 4.5 years that I had there were one of the greatest gifts that came my way, completely out of the blue. But one of the reasons they were a great gift was it gave me a kind of bird's eye view of the church around the world. And that's why I say sometimes the Catholic Church is the greatest show on earth, when you see the truth of what we are around the world. The heroism and the holiness, and God, I mean, in fact, I used to think at times our problem as a church around the world, whatever about Australia or Canberra, is not that we haven't got enough energy, but the energy is volcanic, and it's hard to contain and to control and to husband, as it were, to channel. So the church around the world, don't think that your own backyard is the whole church. That the church around the world, the Catholic Church, is a sleepless 24/7 pageant of the good, the mad, the bad, the sad, and the glad, the mess and the magnificence, the heroism and the holiness, you know, the bold and the beautiful. There's everything. But it is a most fantastic thing to see it. As it is, and I think only God sees the church as the church really is. But from the vantage point of the Vatican, or the Secretariat of State, the private office of the Pope, I saw the church as I never dreamt I would see the church, and I speak out of that experience now, and I guess always, that there's just what we see is each of us is a tiny sliver of a vast mystery that only God sees whole. But the trouble is, sometimes we think that little sliver is all there is. Now, that's one of the reasons, I think, why World Youth Day is such a blast for a lot of young people. What I mean by that is that they leave their own backyard, which is a good place to be, but they walk out of their own backyard and they experience the big church. And any of you who went to Sydney know what I'm talking about. You just get that's only a glimpse, a taste of the whole thing. But it gives you a glimpse or a taste that can last forever, because you sense the vast mystery, that it's not just a clapped-out institution that some human beings concocted for their own solace or advantage. that there is some tremendous mystery. I used to think this when I was working with Pope John Paul. When you see the Pope close up from day to day, as it were, you see what a tremendous mystery and gift the papacy is, the Petrine ministry, the ministry of Peter at the heart of the church. It's a very mysterious thing when you see it close up. The church is like that, not just the Pope, for God's sake. The whole, but what I'm saying is that this is big. This is big. And you and I are tiny parts of it, but to be tiny is also to be precious. See, each of you, you know, is a unique gift to this vast mystery we call the church. Now, that leads me to say, as I move to a point of rest, if not conclusion, that I think that this is a moment of in the life of the church, this time of crisis, that a moment that I would call charismatic. Now, let me explain what I mean. Doesn't mean that we all have to talk in tongues. But what it does mean is this. The question for people like me as a bishop is not, oh, what are the jobs that I've got to have done and who can I get to do them? You know, filling administrative and kind of functional gaps. No, no. If ever that was the question, it's not the question now. The question now, and I think of it as I look around this room, is what are the gifts that God has given to each one of you, and how might that gift be allowed to flourish for the building up of the body of Christ at this time to become more contemplative, more ecclesial, to use that funny word, more the communion that I spoke of, and more missionary. So what's your gift? I don't know. I wish I did. I wish I could just go around and say, yes, this one's, you know, your A, B, C, D, E, and so on. It's not like that. But I can only leave you with the question. What is the gift that you've been given? Because it's there. It might be dormant, unrecognized, but doesn't mean to say it's not there. What's the gift? And whether you're a student or a politician or bishop or God, it doesn't matter. What's your gift? And what might have to happen for it to flourish more and more for the building up of the community, not just for your self-aggrandizement? Now, let me conclude just by looking at one word that somehow gathers up all that I've been trying to say. The word is church. Do you know where it comes from? German has a similar word, Kirche. Scots has Kirk. But the Latin languages following Greek have, again, if you know French, Église, Chiesa, Iglesia. It's a different word. The Latin languages, a word like Église, Ecclesia, comes from the verb to be called out of. So the focus is upon the call. Christ has called us out of darkness into light. That's what the Latin languages and Greek say about the church. And it's true that we are called out of darkness into light. The focus is on the call. But in English and German and similar languages, the word church comes from the Greek word kurios, or the adjective kuriakon, which eventually leads to church in English. What's kurios mean? The Lord. And what does church mean, therefore? The church means that which belongs to the Lord. So the focus now is not so much upon the call, but upon the one who does the calling. All right, so if you want to understand why the Catholic Church is not just a clapped-out institution, why it's not irrelevant, and why it's not just hopelessly intellectualized, though the power of reason at a time when that's under threat is a fundamental part of the Catholic tradition. You know, faith doesn't mean you hang your mind up at the door, even though at times you're made to think that it's like that. The crucial thing, if we are not to be this death-dealing human institution, is that experience of the one whose name we bear. So I come back at the end to where I began. It all starts and it all finishes, not with good old plastic Jesus, but with Jesus Christ crucified, risen from the dead, and here and now probably drinking Guinness. Thank you.
That was Archbishop Mark Coleridge on The Church, the greatest show on earth. Guinness and Guide is presented once a month at King O'Malley's Pub in Canberra. And for more, visit cradio.org.au.